Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
This evening is the seventh yahrzeit of my mother, Shena Necha Bas Shalom, and typically I try to save each year around this time I try to save a good shmooze, the Zeichen Nishmas, my mother. I wish the health that this one should be such. The Gemara in Yuma, Daf Lamed Heyam and Beis, brings down a fascinating event. Brisa says as follows: Oni v'ashiv v'rasha boin ledin. At the end of their days, an oni, a poor man, an ashir, a wealthy man, and a rasha, a wicked man, boin ledin, they come up to Shemayim and they're judged. Loni omrim lo, to the oni they say, mipnei malo asakta b'torah, why weren't you involved in Torah learning? Im Omer, if he answers, Ani Ayisi, I was poor, v'torod b'muzunasi, I was very, very busy with feeding myself. It was rough. I had to make a living, and it was very difficult, and hence I wasn't able to learn. Omrim lo, they say, Klum Ani Ayisi yosem Hillel, you were no poorer than was Hillel. And then the Braisa goes on to bring down the famous event of Hillel, Amru Laval Hillel Hazakin. The Braisa says about Hillel when he was already an older man, that each day he would go out and profit for a tarpik. Rashi explains it's a diner. He would go out and collect wood kindling. That wood kindling he would sell, and he would earn a very small amount of money. Half of it he would give to the Shomer Beis HaMedrash, to the guardsmen at the Beis HaMedrash to allow him in. Half of it he would use to be mefarnes his household. One time it occurred, the Braisa says, he was not able to find even that little bit of money that he normally got. As a result, the Shomer Beis HaMedrash, the guardsmen, would not allow him in. What did Hillel Hazakin do? Olav Nitla. He went up, climbed on top of the roof, sat by the skylight in order that he hear the Divrei Elokim Chaim, the words of Hashem, from the mouths of Shemaya of Avitalion. The Braisa goes on to say that that day was Erev Shabbos, during Teves, in the midwinter, and it began snowing. When the sun rose in the morning, Shemaya said to Avitalion, it's dark in the Beis Medrash. They looked up, they saw an image of a person in the skylight. They immediately went up and found him covered by snow. They freed him, carried him down, washed him, bathed him, put him in front of the fire, and they said these words, Roi zeh l'chal avas haShabbos, this man, it's fit to be mechal haShabbos for, meaning even though they lit the fire, it was perfectly appropriate and proper to be mechal haShabbos. And the Braisa brings down that this is an example of what they say to the Ani. You were poor, you had a rough life, you had it no worse than Hillel. Look what he did, look what became of him. And the Braisa continues, when the Ashir comes to Din, Beis Din Shemala says the same thing. Mibnei malo sakta b'Torah, why weren't you involved in Torah learning? If his answer is, I was rich. V'Torah, you say, I was very, very busy with affairs of state. I had my finances, I had my estate to take care of. Omrim lo, they say to him, Klum asher yisa yosim Rabbi Elazar ben Charsum. You were no wealthier than Rabbi Elazar ben Charsum. And the Braisa says that when Rabbi Elazar ben Charsum's father died, he left him 1,000 cities in the land and 1,000 boats. Remember, in those days, a landowner meant he owned the land. If you have a town, Baltimore, that was named after Lord Baltimore, it's because that huge tract of land was owned by that gevir. This individual, Rabbi Elazar ben Charsum, was left a Yerusha of 1,000 cities and 1,000 boats. Yet each day, he would take a small sack of flour, put it on his shoulders, and go me'ir le'ir from city to city, medina le'medina, lilmo Torah, meaning he had nothing to do with all of his wealth. He would pack just a small amount of dough, a small amount of bread, whatever he needed for his daily meal, and he would travel to learn Torah. Pamachas, one time, matzo avdov, his own avodim, his own servants found him, and they said to him that you're going to have to work. You have to pay the tax. They didn't recognize him to be the landowner. But there was a rule that if you crossed this area, if you stayed in this area, you had to pay the tax. What was the tax? You had to work. Amalahen, he said to him, Bevakashamimchem, please, hanichuni, leave me, ve'elech lumot Torah, let me go learn Torah. Amrulo, they said, Chayi Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, in the name of Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, we're not going to allow you. And in fact, they made him work. The Mashal explains, why didn't he just say, listen, I am Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, what are you making me work for? The Mashal explained, they never would have believed him. They never met the man, they never saw him, and they certainly wouldn't believe that this plain person over here is the great Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, the wealthy man. And the Braisa concludes, Meyamav lo halach v'ra'oson. His entire days he never visited his wealth, his cities. El yoshev osik b'torah kol hayom v'chol halayla. The entire day, the entire night he sat and learned. And again, if the rich man says, I was too busy to learn, they say you were no wealthier than Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, yet look what he became, you too could have. And the Braisa says one more step. If the Rasha comes up to Din, and they say to him, Mipnei Malo Sakta B'Torah, why didn't you learn? If he says, No, Hayisi, I was beautiful, I was gorgeous. V'torad B'Yitzri, my Yetzahara took hold of me. From the time I was a little boy, the girls were after me. They were constantly bothering me. What could you expect from me? Omrim Lo, they say to him, Klum Na Hayisa Mi Yosef, you were no more attractive, you were no more beautiful than Yosef. And the Braisa goes on to say that Yosef HaTzadik each day was haunted by Ashes Potiphar. Yosef was 17 years old. He spent a year in the house of Potiphar, and every day she attempted to seduce him. The clothes that she wore in the morning she would not wear at night. Twice a day she changed. The Medrash tells us she would leave perfume all over, leave her clothes gently flowing with the perfume. She would leave a handkerchief all day long. All she did was try to seduce him, and she wasn't successful. Not only wasn't she successful, he wouldn't look at her. But because he was an Evid, she commanded the Anshe Beis, the people in the house, to put a contraption under his neck. You see, every time she would walk by, he would look down. They put a contraption under his neck with a blade that he couldn't look down. She forced him to look at her. But still he wouldn't give in. And in fact, he passed this year-long nisayon. So when the Rasha comes and says, I had a terrible Yetzirah, I was very attractive, the women were after me, you were no more attractive than Yosef. And in fact, the Gemara concludes, Nimtza comes out, Hillel Machayavis Aniyim, Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom Machayavis Ashirim, Yosef Machayavis Rishayim. Each group is answered, there was a Hillel, there was Rabbi Elazar bar Charsom, there was a Yosef, you could have learned. Now, a quick observation. We are talking in Yom HaDin. We're talking at the end of a person's life, when he leaves this earth, and he's standing in front of Beis Din Shomala. And the excuses that each group says are valid. The poor man really was poor. And poor doesn't just mean you don't have a lot of money, it means you have no money. Working 16 hours a day, not having a clue to how you're going to put food on your table, worried, bothered, haunted by poverty. And riches means really, really being wealthy. Because this is based in Shamala. There's no lying over there. It's truth. The poor man was poor, the rich man was rich, and the Russia really had a tremendous, tremendous Yetzahara. And to each one, Beis Din Shomala gives the answer. And the Shiva asked a very telling question on this Gemara. And the question is that there are many, many reasons not to make it a learning. You could have a weak background, I didn't have a head, I had bad rebbeim, I had bad friends, I was ADD. There are many, many reasons. But if we're talking in front of Beis Din Shomala, then why in the world do they need Hillel? You see, there's only one question. Was this poor man able to learn or not? Well, this is being judged by Hashem. Hashem is quite capable of discerning whether in fact the man really was too poor and couldn't learn or not. Why does Beis Din Shomala need Hillel? Look, Hillel, see, he did it, you could have also. If this judgment is made by Hashem, then either the rich man's claim is correct and Hashem will say he's correct, or the rich man's claim is not correct and Hashem will say so. What do you need the model for? What do you need Hillel? What do you need Rabbi Elazar ben Charsam? What do you need Yosef for? You don't need them. And number two, they're not even relevant. You see, Hillel HaZaken was a singular personality in history. There was only one man who was Hillel HaZaken. Why are you asking this regular person, why weren't you Hillel? I wasn't Hillel because I didn't have his head. I wasn't born to his capacity. I wasn't born in his circumstance. I'm a different human being with a totally different life setting. Why are you comparing me to Hillel? So Rav Shiva asked, what do you need Hillel for? Because Hashem is capable of judging without Hillel. And secondly, Hillel's not relevant. The question is you. Could you have learned or not? And that Hashem would simply answer. So I'd like to deal with this question this evening and try to lend some understanding to this Chazal. And let me begin with an example from a little different part of life. One of the great milestones in competitive sports was the 4-minute mile. For decades, the concept of man running a mile under 4 minutes was viewed as an unattainable goal. It was considered an impossible dream. In 1923, Paavo Nurmi of Finland ran the mile in 4 minutes and 10 seconds. 11 years later, in 1934, Glenn Cunningham dropped it down to 4 minutes and 6 seconds. 11 years after that, in 1945, Gunger Hang of Sweden lowered it to 4 minutes and 1 second, and that's where it stopped. No one could drop it down lower than this, and for a decade, it was considered an impossible barrier to break. As a matter of fact, after years and years, there were all types of theories that came out to explain why it was physically impossible. Doctors began speculating the man's skeletal structures all wrong, his lung capacity is too small, his body creates too much wind resistance. It became an accepted fact that no human being could possibly run a mile in under 4 minutes. Interestingly enough, one runner, an Australian fellow named John Landy, ran the mile 4 times in 4 minutes and 2 seconds. And when he couldn't break that barrier, he said the words, "It's a brick wall." On May 6, 1954, Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Amazingly, within 46 days of Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile, John Landy, the same fellow who 4 times in a row could not do it, broke it also and lowered the speed. He ran it in 3 minutes and 58 seconds. The same fellow who had the brick wall in front of him couldn't break it. The minute Roger Bannister did, he did as well. Within a year of Roger Bannister breaking this barrier, 37 runners did it. Within one more year, 300 runners broke that speed record. That record that had stood for almost 100 years, and maybe longer, that no one could break, once one man broke it, all of a sudden 300 broke it. But the remarkable part about that fact is that nothing changed. They didn't change their technique, they didn't change their running gear, they didn't change their diet, they did everything the same way. The only thing that changed was one man took this event from the realm of the impossible and brought it to the realm of the possible. When Roger Bannister smashed through that brick wall, he made something happen. He made an event possible. Once one human being did it, then it was simple. The barrier has been broken, then anybody can do it. And this is how the Rav Shiva explained this Chazal. That when the Ani comes to Din, he has a very real taina. He was really poor. And anyone looking at the man would have said, "Nebuch, how could you expect a man like that to learn? You can't." And in truth, he couldn't have learned, except for the fact that one time in history there was a man named Hillel. And once Hillel smashed through that barrier, once Hillel took himself from that impoverished state and actually grew and became the great Hillel, he broke that barrier and now anyone can do it. And when the Gemara says that Hillel's Mechayev and Aniyim, it means because Hillel became the hero. Hillel became the man who broke through that psychological barrier, who made himself into something, a man coming from the same circumstances as I, yet he towered to such greatness. Once there was one human being in history who did it, who broke through that brick wall, then anyone can do it. And now, in fact, the Ani could have done it as well. And when the usher says, I was so rich, I had no time. They were banging down my doors. They wouldn't stop with the stucco collectors and the troubles and this institution. I was supporting the whole city. They say to him one thing. There was once a great hero called Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum. Had you used that image in front of you as a galvanizing point, had you held that hero up in front of you, you too could have learned. And in fact, when the Gemara says that Hillel's Machayev Tzaniyim, what it means is that once it was such a person, now anyone can do it. Now when the Rishiv explained this Chazal, he also explained the importance of having heroes. The importance of having people in our lives who are inspirational, who we look up to, who we try to model ourselves after, who we try to aspire to be like. And the Rishiva said that this is a very, very important yesod for really growing, for a person becoming great. And I was a young man when I heard this concept. And it was ironic because in the yeshiva at the time, there was a big push for Musa Chaburas. Musa Chaburas was a small group of guys who would get together. And once a week, the idea was one fellow would present, whether it be a Chazal, whether it be a Gemara. And in a small group, everyone would discuss it and strategize. And the idea being to mimachazik one another, a small Musa Chabura. Happened to be, I was invited to join a very exclusive group of guys, very serious group. And each week someone would present, the Chazal, the Gemara, whatever it be. And it came my turn to present. And I brought not a Gemara, not a Chumash, and not a Musa Sefer. I showed up with a sports book, a picture book of the life of Muhammad Ali, the boxer. And I remember, again, these were serious guys, and I got a look or two of like, what exactly are you doing? So then I opened up the book to one page that I had flagged, and I showed him a famous picture. It's a picture of Muhammad Ali in 1973, both hands over his head in victory. This was the fight, the second fight between Frazier and Ali. This was one of the greatest fights in history. And Ali won this fight. And I said to everyone, you see, do you see that picture? At which point those stares became glares, as in Schaefer, this better be something very, very good because you're pushing it. And then I said, here's the punchline. What you see in front of you is Muhammad Ali, the champion. But what they don't tell you about in the sports section of the papers is the fact that immediately after that fight, he was checked into a hospital where he spent the next 3 weeks recuperating. Because the great champion, the victorious fighter, was so beaten up that he could not get out of his hospital bed for 3 weeks. And the reason why I told the guys that this is a great Musar lesson is because you see the glory, you see the champion, but rarely do you see the hard work and the tough knocks that it takes to get there. And anytime you see someone standing in the winner's circle, no one understands there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into getting there. You don't see it when you see his hands clenched under over his head. You see the glory, but you don't see the heavy price he had to pay. Muhammad Ali is quoted as saying, now, I don't know if you've, I may be dating myself by mentioning even his name and the dates. Muhammad Ali, when I was a young man, was known as Pretty Boy Ali. He was the one fighter who couldn't be touched. He used to duck, he used to move. You couldn't touch the guy. He was the cleanest fighter. He once estimated that in his professional career, he was hit 1 million times. That means the Chayara, weighing 220 pounds, slugged him full force in the jaw 1 million times during his fighting career. This was the cleanest of the fighters. And he once was quoted in an interview saying an amazing line. He says, it is almost impossible for a professional prize fighter to be knocked unconscious. They're so trained, they're in such great shape that any time you see a fighter not coming off the canvas for the count, it's not that he's unconscious, it's that he's lost the will to fight. He's gotten so beat up, suffered so much pain that he doesn't want to get up. And I shared with the guys then that what I believed was the point that this is a great lesson for success in life. That ultimately your ability to take a punch, your ability to be hit and keep on fighting, your ability to be committed to a goal, to a cause, and keep on pushing is one of the great lessons to be learned from sports, because ultimately it's one of the great secrets to success in almost every endeavor. And I think there's great musa to learn from athletes. I was once at, when Rav Avram Chaim Feuer was being maspid his father-in-law Rav Gifter, Rav Feuer said over a very interesting event, he said, Rav Gifter grew up in America, and he grew up as an adolescent much like any other adolescent. There was one thing unusual about his youth. In his room, he had a mirror. Much like other adolescents, he would look in the mirror. That wasn't the unusual part. It was what surrounded the mirror. Around this mirror in the room were all the pictures of Gedolim of his day. Rav Baruch Ber, Rav Shimon Shkup. But says Rav Feuer, that was not the unusual part of the mirror. It was the words on top of the mirror. On top of the mirror were the words, "Why not you?" And apparently every day, Rav Gifter would go over to this mirror, look at the pictures of the Gedolim, read the words on top, and say to himself those words, "Why not you?" And interestingly enough, there was no reason why not, because Rav Gifter became, it tells the Reshiva, Gadol B'Yisrael, and there was no reason that he didn't become a Gadol, because he did. And I think that this is one of the great mistakes that people make. You see, Muhammad Ali said one telling line at the end of his career. Do you know what he said? He said that I hated every minute of training. I hated it. But I said to myself, better to suffer now and be a champion for the rest of my life than to go down as a nobody. And that's a tremendous, tremendous yesod. You know what that yesod is? The yesod is that a man said to himself, I am worth it. I am worth it to struggle for. I have goals, I have aspirations. I can make myself into something. And he held himself a goal and he reached for it, was willing to pay the price, and ultimately reached greatness in his small circle. But that's exactly what we see from Rav Gifter. When Rav Gifter would look in the mirror, you know what he said to himself? Those are Gedolei Yisrael, great, great men. Who could ever envision, who could ever dream of being as great as Rav Baruch Ber, as Rav Shimon Shkup? You know who could? I can. Because I, like them, am human. I, like them, have been given capacity. I, like them, have been created in the image of Hashem, and I can succeed. And when he would look in the mirror and he'd see their picture and see himself in the mirror, he would say, why not you? And that drove him to become who he became. And I dare say, if he didn't do that exercise, if he didn't hold heroes in front of him, if he didn't hold up an image of a great man and say, I too can be like that, he may very well not have become who he could become. And I think it's a very, very important lesson in life to find heroes and to say to yourself, why not me? Why can't I do just like what they've done? And I think it's unfortunate that in our society, in our world, we're schooled in a very, very different thought process. Come on, what am I? I'm not some world-class runner. I'm not a great boxer. I'm not a Gadol B'Yisrael. What does this have to do with me? Gentlemen, you'll hear it over and over. Chazal after Chazal explained that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu put man on this planet, he did not put man on this planet for mediocrity. Man was created to be great. Man was given tremendous potential. And ultimately, what prevents most people from reaching that potential is a limit of belief. Not a limit of capacity, not a limit of talents, but a limit of belief. They're held in check. They're held into this very tight, defined, little person. And they say to themselves, that's all I am. That's all I can be. Hence, most people do not reach a fraction of what they can be. But to become great, there is a price that you have to be willing to pay. And it's a heavy price, but if you understand it, that it's part of the price, it's easier to bear the price. The price that you have to pay to be great is you have to be willing to fail. You see, it's part of success. Part of any human being who ever succeeded, any human being who ever made himself into something, any human being who ever aspired and became great had many, many failings along the way. And I believe that if you are not failing at something in life, if you are not on a semi-regular basis finding yourself on the floor and saying to yourself, I failed, if you're not failing, then I believe that you're failing at life. Because if in fact you're setting goals, if in fact you're aspiring for things, then almost by definition you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, you're going to make some of those goals, and you're not going to make some. But if you find yourself, hey, life is okay, I don't really fail much, then most likely what that means is you're not aspiring, you're not growing, and you're failing at life. Because part of success, a big part of success, is failure. And I want to share with you a quote. And I'll tell you the quote first. And after I tell you the quote, I'll tell you who said the quote. The quote goes as follows. Success consists of going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. Again, success consists of going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. Who said that line? Was it some Pushkin a Mensch, some regular guy? That line was coined by a man who was a college professor, a historian, a philosopher, a winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, a world statesman, knighted by the Queen of England and the Prime Minister of England. That line was coined by Sir Winston Churchill, who, interestingly enough, personified that exact line after he saved the free world from the Nazi regime. After he led the Allies to victory, he very shortly found himself voted out of office. Amazingly, in May 1945, Germany surrendered. In July 1945, Churchill was voted out of office. After bringing England to her finest hour, he found himself unemployed. After which, he went on to write a six-volume work in history that won him the Nobel Prize, after which he went on to fight communism. But the point being, he lived these words. And gentlemen, that's a great yesod. Because typically we look at great people and we say, wow, they were headed like a meteor, straight up. They were from success to success to success. Says a man who was arguably the most successful human being in the 20th century. Would you like the definition of success? He says what it is. Going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Knowing that I've fallen, but I'm going to pick myself back up. I'm going to set my sails. I'm going to set my sights. And going back to fight. And if you wonder why it is that so many people don't suffer failures, it's not because they're great, it's because they're not fighting. They're not setting goals, they're not aspiring, they don't have a clue to their potential, so they're just floating. If you float, it's true. You don't fall very often because you're not fighting the fight. And in fact, I've heard it said in the name of Rav Huttner, who wrote in one of his letters, he said, typically people misunderstand what it means to be a gadol. You assume a gadol b'Yisrael, by the time he was 3, he was learning Mishnayos. By the time he was 10, he mastered Shas, and then he really sat down to learn. Says Rav Huttner, that beautiful picture that you get is patently false. Because it doesn't open up to you what really was happening. Because says Rav Huttner, every gadol who made himself into something fell down and had to pick himself up, fell down and had to pick himself up, fell down 7 times. 7 times the tzaddik falls. And each time he falls, he picks himself up and says, Rav Hutna, that's a great yesod in being a gadol. And my friends, I think it's a tremendous lesson for us to learn. The Ani had a very hard life. He couldn't have done it. But once he had a hero, once he had a man like Hillel who was there as his image, he now could make it. The rich man had a lot of tirdas, a lot of worries and troubles and bothers, but there was once a man like Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum. Now the rich man could reach heights that he couldn't before. He had a hero, he had a mirror, he could look in and say, why not you? If they could, I could as well. And the Russia who had a great Yitzhara, not a little one, a great one, had an answer. There was once a man like Yosef, who was 17 years old at the height of his passion, being put in an impossible situation. If he could win it, so can you. And ultimately, a man like Roger Bannister brought something to the world of running. That something was not a change in technique, wasn't a change in form, was a change in attitude. He took something from the realm of impossible and made it possible, and that's what heroes do. And heroes don't have to be Rabbi Elazar bar Charsum's. They don't have to be necessarily Hillel. Heroes have to be people that you look up to, people that you say, wow, that's a great man, I wish to be like him. And if a person attaches himself to that image, sets himself the goal of being that, he can become great and reach real heights. For you guys who are have come enough times to the Musar Shmooze, you know that I like to introduce something called a Musar exercise. I have a Musar exercise to share with you that I think is a very growth-oriented Musar exercise. I want you to look back at the last milestone in your life. Find an event maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, depending on your life stage, whether it was your bar mitzvah, whether your wedding, maybe the birth of your first child. Look back at that event and see yourself there. See yourself at that event, and you'll see that it's you, the same you who's right here. Feel yourself there, and now in the same mind's eye, I want you to see yourself right now here. And I want you to ask yourself one core question. And that question is, am I the same person? Am I the same person here now as I was 7 years ago? And my friends, if the answer is yes, that's a very scary thought. If I haven't grown dramatically, if I haven't changed in a very real way, if I can't say about myself now that I'm much improved, that I'm a different human being, then to some extent, I've wasted the past 5, 6, maybe 7 years of my life. Probably the saddest words a human being can ever say are the words that we hear so often. Would've, could've, should've. I would've been somebody, I could've been somebody, I should've been somebody, but I'm not. Gentlemen, those words are so heavy and they're so sad. And I think that if you're like most people on the planet, you probably have a secret dream. Most people walk around this planet with a secret dream of one day being somebody. They dream, they aspire to be somebody great, to really accomplish things, to really be a great individual. And unfortunately, for the vast majority of people, that dream got pushed away long ago and just sort of lay there and is sort of untouched. If you take one thing from Hillel, from Rav Hutna, from Rav Gifter, that one thing to do is to take out that dream, dust it off, blow off the layers of dust, put it up in front of yourself and say, why not? Why not? Why not you? And I have one more part to this Musa exercise. If you take the same image of you right now, where you're holding right now, and go to the next milestone in your life, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years forward, and picture yourself now, picture yourself then, and ask yourself the key core question. Are you going to be the same person 5 years from now as you are now? And gentlemen, do you know that unless you change, you will be. Unless you make a very real decision to grow, unless you set yourself some major, serious goals, you will be identical then to what you are now. And it's a little sad. I'll share with you something of great interest. There was a book written by Mark McCormick. The book is entitled What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. And in this book, he tells of a study that was done in Harvard Business School. The study was done between the years 1979 and 1989. The study involved interviews with the graduates of the Harvard MBA program, and they were asked one question. As they were graduating, the graduates were asked, "Have you set clear written goals for your future and made plans to accomplish them?" This was the question that the graduates were asked, and only 3% of the graduates had written goals. 13% had goals, but not in writing. A full 84% had no specific goals other than getting out of school and enjoying the summer. That was in 1979. The interviewers followed these students after they graduated, repeated interviewing them, and in 1989, studied their economic success. And this is what they found. They found that the 13% who had goals but weren't in writing were earning on average twice as much as the 84% that had no goals. Interesting. But the surprising part was that the 3% of the graduates who had written goals were earning 10 times as much as the entire group of the 97% were. The small 3% alone were earning 10 times as much as the entire group of the 97%. The only difference between the groups, no difference in capacity, no difference in IQ, the difference being one group had clearly defined written goals, the other one didn't. An amazing study. And gentlemen, I believe that this is one of the great, great secrets to success in life, to have clear written goals. And a written goal means exactly that. On paper, written out, I will fill in the blank. But a goal, you have to understand, is not a 3-month plan, nor a 6-month plan, not even a year plan. A goal means 5 years down the line. Typically, any goal that's really worth aspiring takes 5 years or longer. And you have to fill in the blank. In 5 years, I will be, and write it in. In 5 years, I will be such and such. Then what you have to do after writing that down is you have to write the roadmap. How do I plan on getting there? And that you do on a yearly basis, on a monthly basis, on a day-to-day basis. But gentlemen, if you don't write down your goals, you're not committed to it, you'll never succeed. And if you do write them down, you find an amazing thing. You find the wherewithal, you find the way, and you're able to reach heights. It's an amazing lesson from Hillel. The lesson is that that man could have been great. The Oni could have been, had he used his hero. The lesson from Rav Gifter's mirror is just as great. And that lesson is that man was created for godless, for greatness. But you have to hold yourself up to the why not you. You have to find a hero. You have to find a great objective. You have to find a great goal. Find a human being who's already accomplished that and say to yourself, why not me? And then you have to write down that goal. You have to write it down on paper, commit yourself to it, and an amazing thing happens. It transforms your life. Because unfortunately, most people on this planet wander aimlessly. What do you really want in life? What are you living for? I don't know, I'm here. I don't know, I'm making a living, you know, hanging out. And unless you commit to a very specific, clearly written set of goals, you will be, like most people on the planet, wandering aimlessly. Hence, you will not accomplish but a fraction of what you could have been. And those 3%, even though we don't gauge our success in life on money, but for that study, that was the criteria, 3% earning 10 times as much as the other 97% because they had clearly defined a mission, a passion, goals that were written down, hence they were like a laser focused and it transformed their life. A great, great key to success. And gentlemen, I'd like to close with an observation. And that observation is, could you imagine what it's like to be that Ani on Yom HaDin? Here's a man, lived his life, said the lines, and all of his life he said to himself, listen, I had a rough life, and it was true. And considering from where I came, considering my life situation, I did okay. And don't forget, his whole life has been saying that. And in one flash of reality, in one moment, they show him Hillel, and they say that's what you could have been. Could you imagine the pain that the man feels at that moment when he sees the bluff, it was a fake, those lines that I kept saying to myself over and over were empty? And if you really can envision that and see that pain, now you could understand the value of life. You see, one of the great secrets of life and the most empowering thought that a human probably can have is that every moment that there's breath in my body is a chance to grow. Every moment of time that I exist, I can change, I can grow, I can become, I can be a different human being at the end of a day than I was at the beginning, certainly at the end of a month, certainly at the end of a year, Kavachomer at the end of 5 years, if there's one thing in place, if I have a direction, if I have goals, if I've written them down and I'm committed to them. If not, life is squandered away. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom to see our potential, the courage to live up to it, and ultimately the siyata deshmaya to see people, to be around people who can inspire us, who can inspire us to grow, can inspire us to steig, and to become what we're destined to be.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as Maaser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.